see so much work, it's all kind of gathered in, whether I'm writing about theater or, you know, or music or dance or visual art or food or the Hudson Valley or something, because they're all, it's all kind of infused through this way. But I have to say, I'm just not a personality type that gets involved so much or that's drawn to, you know, the negative, the underside of things, the politics, the grotesque. Like I said, I'm more leaning toward Roland Barthes than Artaud, you know, or more toward Bachelard when I say things like the dining table is the center of the table. That's pure, you know, Bachelard. That's my orientation, more toward phenomenology, more toward a softness and poetic type way of trying to deal with being in the world. But I think you can still deal with political and social issues in that way. I've just gone purposely against the theoretical drift because I just prefer a kind of writing rather than a certain kind of theoretical mode of looking at things.
But
can I just respond? I didn't mean it as a
oh yeah.
It wasn't meant as a theory.
No,
it was more like another kind of traveling. And
yeah.
What I was thinking about, for example, Rabelais, where Gargantua is born, mm-hmm. and the first thing he says is, to drink, mm-hmm. you know, and on we start. And yes, this is a very parodic and critical Renaissance work, but it is a work of art and
exactly.
uses language mm-hmm. in ingestion, digestion. So I was just meaning it as part of that entire enjoyment of food as also something that is excessive. I didn't mean it as a theory.
No, especially with the French intellectuals.
That's right, yeah.
You know. And also you're not anti-language as material, because that's what I think, you know, and in everything you're doing, it's enormously material as food is. Can I bring in Kristen and then...
citing, you know, influences like Bard or Sontag. Mm-hmm. I was thinking it's a classic kind of essay, mm-hmm. And that I love essay because it's just a really freeing kind of way of writing. And I don't know the whole history of it. Maybe other people are more familiar, but I know that Montaigne was like an early mm-hmm. essayist, mm-hmm. and I think at that time it was considered quite excessive, quite a strange way of writing, kind of almost a monstrous text in some ways, kind of just lurking out everywhere and talking about his thinking and ideas. But one of the things I like is the way you do weave in certain kind of critiques, and one of them that I heard that I thought was kind of interesting was this idea of the homogenization of art in order to become mm-hmm. palatable across
right.
cultures. And I was wondering if you could talk a little mm-hmm. bit about that, because that seemed quite...
Well, yeah, I made a comment about, just the way that food is standardized to travel mm-hmm. more. There's so much loss of flavor in food, everyone talks about that, that it's the same thing. If you go look at art in different countries, a lot of it is losing its distinctiveness of the local. That's a whole other issue, the local versus the international. Art is so international, and it's promoted that way, and there's so many art fairs. But, I mean, like recently, say, like last winter, if I go to the New York Art Fair, there's several piers, you know, going down to the water of contemporary art from so many galleries around the world. And there's a lot of it that's the same because of the art market. I don't know whether that will change. By the same token, it's interesting to think about the local and the international with performance, because one of the things about, I think, like Pina Bausch, something about the lack of, I mean, something about the change of her work in the last 10 or 15 years is that you can see that it's work made for any festival or country that she's invited to, and she can capture that essence of that culture, but it's no longer the same as pieces she did 20 or 25 years ago, because they're traveling, they're appealing to more people, but it's lost something of its initial flavor. Bob Wilson's another example of an artist who can work in any country or culture, but the work is still kind of Wilsonian in a way of his style, but he can he can adapt, or Peter Brook or someone like that. So I think part of the loss of interest in drama and dramatic literature today has to do with the fact of its localness, mm-hmm. that it's just not traveling so much as it used to, and it's becoming very local. People no longer know a lot of foreign writers, and also because it's rooted to the local and the topical. Mm. So that's like that's one of the art forms I think that is losing its strength.
So we'll just kind of make it a little bit more, you know, simple, kind
palatable.
Of, yeah, and kind of carved down some. So I think mm-hmm. it's interesting because I think performance is so strong in terms of wrapping those things up. But
like you, I have an Italian background, and but ate my way around Umbria. Similarly, obviously it doesn't show. I was a chef when I was younger, and then became a director. So. I've always felt an intrinsic link with food and eating and a feeding of the soul, if you like, a feeding of the body, the soul, with art and performance. And I just think I've almost never divorced the two, which is why I came along tonight. I was very kind of interested to hear what you wanted us, what you were going to say. And I loved it. I echo Kate. It was very interesting. And I kind of, but I really worry, I mean, I come from family where the table is the center of the drama. Mm-hmm. The family argue, the family love, make up around that table, around food. I do the dinner parties and it's very theatrical and I make sure that everyone knows how fantastic this is and how wonderful that is and whatever, and it is an event. And I kind of wonder where society is going around that. And I do worry that despite Marks and Spencer's inviting you to only eat with one person for £10, or get two for four people because you can do that. Works quite well. You get a bottle of red. Anyway, kind of where that's going. I wonder if it's going further apart or if you see it further apart or coming together. I don't know.
I think that it's important for people to meet and talk again. I guess I can't speak for British society, but all I can speak is the drift in New York society where there's just people are just workaholics and they're just working too much and not really getting together. One of the differences between living abroad and being in New York is how much time people do spend eating and talking and having conversations and how often friends see each other. It's not like making an appointment. You just see each other over and over and over again and talk. I don't think we have that culture in the United States. I can't say now how much it will change and if it will change. I have that different kind of life up in the Hudson Valley where I spend a good 5 or 6 months going back and forth or being part of there in the summer, and it's a little bit different. It's more of a settled kind of life, but I think the important thing is that because of all the, the technology and everything, that we're losing this sense of really taking responsibility for friendship, having a face-to-face conversation instead of being able to say things or do things by email that become maybe irresponsible or leaving things on phone messages. I feel that the character of people is definitely changing over these last couple of years. And it's really, in a way up to people to get back to some kind of humanness instead of being like driven so far along and so disconnected by so many of these means of technologies. Now, I'm not celebrating, the traditional family and all of that. I mean, I'm really not. But I think it'd be good. I think that people shouldn't worry about what they're making or how expensive a meal it is or what kind of sophisticated ingredients it is or anything. You can make a great dish of, you can make a great dinner of pasta for like £2 or £3, frankly, for people. And people would just be happy, to be eating and conversing and talking. I don't know what impact all this would have on the arts, but I think people are generally and universally dissatisfied and feeling bankrupt by so much of, say, theater, if I talk about my own profession, or even maybe live art. I mean, you wonder, like, what's it all about, all this going out all the time and going to performances and going to see things. What are people really saying about our lives? What's so significant about it? You know, what do we really need?
Maria.
Was really about branding and how our culture of food and the pleasure around food has been so bound up with the culture of branding,
mm-hmm.
and a global culture of branding, that he links into the kind of whole idea of the festival culture, that actually in many ways what he's saying in the production is around doing more for the festival circuit of McDonald's-like products that will travel well, whether they're live art products or versions of Shakespeare or whatever, that have a particular recognisable global brand, and very much uses metaphors of food, if you like, to kind of articulate that idea. And a lot of it is linked around fragmentation of existence. People don't sit around a table and eat. They'll eat in tables for two at McDonald's or over the counter or take it away with them. And that idea of, and he looks at the kind of geography of a McDonald's restaurant, which is about small kind of disunified things where people really don't have to face each other. They can kind of face a window or a wall, but anything but each other. And it seemed to me to be tying up a lot of the things that were being said around pleasure or lack of pleasure.
We started the conversation talking about that in a way, and that's the thing also. Performance art, for example, it started out like in the 60s with being about the pleasure of the body, then it became about the disease, and then the body became a socially contested space. And we really moved really far away from the idea of the body and also nudity and all these things that were connected with freedom and lack of censorship and pleasure to really thinking about pleasure is a kind of a guilt thing, or it always has to be socially or politically inscribed or something. You know, I find this also in teaching. If you teach the history of performance art, the way that people think about the body, nudity at one time is celebrated, then it was thought of as against women or something, different. The way that Carol Buscema, for example, was considered as a figure over a period of decades. One went to then denigrating the celebration, say, of heterosexuality in her work. Mm-hmm. So we have all these, everybody knows that now, we have so many conflicting ideas about the body and about pleasure. And it's also hard to think about having so much pleasure. I talked about people having designer bottles of water when so much of the world doesn't have enough water, or with people buying a lot of food and then dieting and eating half their plate. I remember coming back from the Soviet Union in 1988, where it was so odd. Like, if I went around the GUM, the department store, they had so few articles, they had only the pictures of objects mm-hmm. in the window, mm-hmm. in the store windows, like watches and jewelry and things. Mm-hmm. And then I flew back to Copenhagen. Now, Copenhagen is hardly the paragon of corruption in the Western world, and yet it just seemed like there was just so much, it was so plentiful, it was almost obscene. So I have to say, we really are confused about what's really important, in life today. Because of these issues, we can't be settled in the world any longer, but we still have to find a way to be happy in the world. And actually, I'm just thinking now, I'm saying this because I'm reading Alain de Botton, whose work I like very much. And I guess he's grappling with a lot of these dilemmas. I was just reading his book, How Proust Can Change Your Life, which is really marvelous about this art of living.
And I'm just thinking about the Madeleine.
Yeah.
Also the
yes.
Or Babette's Feast. You think of how Isaac Dinesen or Karen Blixen, as in Europe, understood that so much about food.
Yeah.
mini sandwiches. I like that one.
I took Shakespeare around Poland in 84, and I will never forget one of our company complaining that there wasn't enough meat in what the Polish people gave us. And when I found out it took 6 months to print a poster, for them even to give us meat was quite outstanding. Mm-hmm. Like you, there were the same size shoes in the shop, but different styles, all different styles and the same size. It was country going through an incredible change. And the love that these Polish artists kind of gave us, and the amazing generosity, and to have this namby-pamby idiot ended up working for BT, complaining about the meat, that's quite something.
It is striking when one travels and realize that people might have to work weeks to give you meat as a guest, or that they'll go without something.
Absolutely.
You know, to give it to you.
Okay, no problem.
Or as the honored guest, to get the sheep's eyes.
Say something about what you eat. What do you like?
Last night I had some broccoli and pasta and a glass of wine. Well, it depends whether you're going to the theater in England or France. Because sometimes it starts at 9 o'clock there. I don't know. It's just part. You know, it's just part of the rituals of eating. One of the nice things about going to the theater in Europe is that there often are restaurants and cafes where you can have a drink at intermission or after, or you can eat. One of the terrible things about the American theater is that there aren't really bookstores in theaters, and the lobbies are very small in many theaters. I'm thinking particularly, off mainstream. And there's no socializing after. So I think that the social act of going to theater is really missing in American theaters, where it's very prominent in England, it's very prominent in Germany, and many other countries I go to. And that also gives a different tinge to the event, because after you go to an event, you want to sit down and talk with someone about it. But if suddenly the restaurant is closed for union reasons, it's so peculiar. You think, what are these people thinking of? There's no concept of the social, but the problem is that, as with many things, a lot of people just don't complain. They don't change things. They don't complain. It's just an accepted way of being. But that's very different in the European theater, the idea of going and sitting afterwards and conversing about a work and doing that at long intermissions or afterwards. It's not, our theater is not at home conducive to that. And I think that says a lot about the culture. Friday I'm going.
Where the practice of tomato throwing was rife, I imagine, at some point. And I was quite amused by this passage in your piece on why is it that we express our discontent by throwing food on actors, mm-hmm. and tomatoes in particular, or apples.
Politicians more recently, or shoes, actually.
Yesterday I was speaking to a Mexican artist who uses food in incredibly varied ways in his performance. It goes from anything like one particular disturbing piece uses mother's milk to make cheese, which he then presents on a, it's, this is in response to wet nursing as a practice, and it's incorporated in an exhibition to do with work and slavery and so forth. But one piece he's working on currently is to do with the Tomasina, I believe, festival that I had never heard of before, but it takes place in Valencia in Spain, and apparently it's people really go for it and all throw tomatoes at each other. Mm. And I was wondering how this could possibly be connected to this this practice. Possibly not. Why tomatoes were used in such a way? So the artist is trying to juxtapose this with the practice of competitive eating, and here the notion of excess crops up again.
You know what? Since I'm in London, I'll say this: it's always disturbed me that the English audience threw food at Judy Garland. She appeared here. She died in June 1969. I saw her last performance in March 1969, which was in Copenhagen. She had then been, she moved to England. She had recently gotten married, and she appeared, I think it was in April, at the Palladium. I find it disturbing that an audience would throw food at a great artist.
And it's equally curious to think that people would go to the theater with
bags. Yeah.
I mean, it might not have been a great period. She was only in her 40s then, and it was, okay, say it's not a really good period. But the idea that you would do that to a great artist, I find very disturbing about an audience, about the psychology of an audience. It's always bothered me about it. In fact, I was recently in a bookstore on the way here looking for some of these duplicate postcards to see if there was something about Judy Garland from 1969, from that performance at the Palladium. I just find that very disturbing. Is that something that British audiences do? Yeah, I don't know why people would do that. Did they have food on them?
Well, there used to be this thing of having people in the stocks. You were not punished for it. You were held in these wooden contraptions in the Middle Ages, and things would be thrown at you. Was it rotten vegetables?
I think so.
Since you're talking about that, look at waterboarding. What do? They put tons of water on people drinking, and Chinese torture and all that. So the excess of drinking or eating is also another form of torture, self-inflicted or can be inflicted by someone else. That is a big part of torture. But I want to go back to where you started. Okay, so you said that the tape was going to have a table in which people were going to talk. What were they expected to do then? That's a very intimate situation than giving a lecture. What do you think people would want to talk about?
Well, we'll see. It's on in June. And I really was just alluding to the fact that I think, and it's a great place to end, really, the idea that coming to the table again seems to have many different aspects, and it seems to have come back into the culture in quite a big way. Somebody was mentioning Spill, and Lois Keeden from Live Art Development Agency has been developing this notion of the table. We held a table event here last year in this very room, actually. So I think it's just something that seems to perhaps respond to what you're talking about the need to gather around a table, the need for friendship and exchange in ways that isn't just a conventional kind of artist speaking or conference situation. But I think what we should
I
don't know what they're going to talk about.
But it's interesting because it forces you into a larger commitment face to face than at a distance.
Yes, it's a different form of engagement.
You can't also speak in a theoretical way to someone 5 feet from you.
No.
So in other words, the language will change.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just curious, like everyone else, like what's really important to think about or do today?
Yeah.
After seeing decades of work and everything, and I sometimes ask myself, why am I going? Is it like a routine? What am I getting out of this? I don't really know. There's so few works that are really important to see anymore.
Mm.
I mean, really the issue. So what is it that people want to talk about? They have to come with big topics if you're talking that close.
Or very, very short things, not short and trivial, because I was going to say one of the things that it seems to me that you've been talking about is also the significance of what's actually overlooked in the ordinariness of everyday exchange, and actually attending to that, like John Cage with mushrooms, and absolutely obsessive attention to something very small. And perhaps that's what's somewhere in the new thing. Ellen, and then
well,
we'll...
This is a little closer to
yeah.
That. There's, I don't know if you've been at the University of Life in London, and they organize dinner parties. I think it's, you know, kind of handy if you haven't got
yeah.
to do it and sort of really want to expand yourself. But they also have dinner parties where they provide topics for you.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the School of Life is we were talking about the other day, run by, started by Alain de Botton, is one of those things that new cultural centres, in a sense, that's evolving around very different practices of I think, of engagement. I think we've got to stop.
Okay.
It's just such a pleasure to have Bonnie here, and I think in a way you've also, you've regaled us with many tales, but you've also ended up with a kind of manifesto for friendship and pleasure, without ignoring some of the darker sides of what's happened in art practice, and also the kinds of things that we might think about politically, even though you say you're not always a political writer. In fact, there's a great politics and a great sort of politics of community there. And I want to thank you again for your generosity, not just tonight, but the whole of the last few months. And I hope that your next 2 weeks here, we've got a few more events to go, one on editing actually on Thursday, will also be as enjoyable as this one has been tonight. And to thank everyone for coming. Thank
you
very much, Bonnie.